All right. Well, for this next part of the meeting, we'll take a look at the next section of 1 Peter that we've been studying, which is going to be 1 Peter 4, verses 12 to 19. And I asked Walter Jr. if he'd read them for us. So.
All right. 1 Peter 4, 12 through 19. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. But let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or as a meddler. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. I found it a little interesting that it kind of goes along with what Matthew was saying. You know, Paul and Silas, they were rejoicing in that they were suffering, and not that we would expect, you know, good things to happen because of that, but it did in that case.
Yeah, well, if you have thoughts to share, just raise your hand and David will bring the mic, or you're welcome to stand up front here if you want.
I read this morning, and it's interesting. It kind of comes on the coattails of encouragements to do good, like in verse 7 and 8. To be self-controlled, to be sober-minded for the sake of prayers, and above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Show hospitality to one another without grumbling. As each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever speaks, to speak as the oracles of God. Whoever serves, as one who serves by the strength that God supplies, in order that everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. And then he goes on to again talk about suffering. And years and years ago, when my wife and I started having children, there was a relative of ours that didn't have any children, but she was always talking about natural consequences. That was this big philosophy that she had grabbed hold of, was natural consequences for bad behavior. So when a child, you know, screams, they don't get something, or when they use violence, they lose out on something. Natural consequences for behavior. And it's interesting, there is definitely a kind of suffering that you can bring on yourself. If you murder, you're going to be thrown in jail or be hunted. Or if you're a thief, it's going to be required of you, whatever you stole. Or if you're an evildoer or a meddler. And there's definitely in this passage a command to not do those things and be suffering on account of those things because of the natural consequences of those actions. But we're supposed to suffer for doing these good things, these things that are good in the face of a world filled with evil. That's how we're supposed to suffer. And at the end, there's in verse 19 of what Walter read there, there's this thing that I think, if we're all honest, is extremely difficult to do. To entrust our souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. It's this whole idea of suffering to the point of loss and destruction. To be able to trust God when when it goes that way, when Christianity isn't the cherry on top of your life, but it's actually ruining things that we take for granted. Having provision, having a place to be that you call your own, having things that make us feel secure. When all of those things start disappearing, we're supposed to entrust ourselves to our Creator. Just an interesting concept that I think is easy to gloss over and read, but really difficult to put into practice. And it's what we're commanded to do. Anyway, those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for those thoughts, Brother Max. A couple thoughts I had that are also kind of tied in with what you shared about, like, about suffering from natural consequences. And I think it's really nice how Peter put it here. Like, it's one of the overall theme in this whole book is about suffering, and how to think about suffering, and then how to respond to suffering, and how to endure it. And here in verse 12, you know, he's after, as you said, some encouraging verses. He says, "But don't be surprised if you suffer, as if something strange is happening. This is a testing. But down here, like in verse, let's see." Verse 14 says, "If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed." Yeah, verse 14 says, "If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you." And so that's, you know, that's a, it's good to have that verse. It's encouraging. And then Peter goes on to say, "Make sure none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a troublesome meddler." And I think that list could be a whole lot longer, because I think there's people, and one of the things that comes to my mind is, like, I've just met a lot of people over the years who, from what I could discern, you know, claim to be Christians, but were filled with some kind of arrogance or something, in which they, whether it's the arrogant street preacher who just, you know, basically, like, screams down people or something, and then gets persecuted for it, and he's like, "Yeah, here's my crown, you know, here's my rejoicing," or whether it's, doesn't have to be a street preacher, and, you know, just somebody who is just arrogant about his beliefs or arrogant about what he believes and acts foolishly with the truth or the truth he thinks he has or the faith that he thinks he has. And then there'd be people who, whether it be other brothers or well-meaning people, who would try to point something out. And you know, this can happen, whether it's the person with maybe, like, who's very strict about his life, and there's going to inevitably, maybe unreasonably strict, and there's inevitably going to be people, other well-meaning brothers, who are like, "You know, brother, think about some of the consequences this has on others," or whatever. Or there's the person that maybe is way too loose or too liberal, and there's well-meaning brothers or Christians that are like, you know, approach him or are like, can't you see what this, can't you see what's in the wake of this, or what's happening, or what it's doing to your soul, or whatever. And if a person carries himself arrogantly and may just be like, "Yeah, this is what happens, you know, because of Christ's sake, I'm getting persecuted. And really, it's his foolishness that he's toting. And here's the thing I thought this morning that's interesting, and I feel like this happens often in Scripture. Like, there'll be these kind of verses, and it gets followed very quickly with something else. And it does here, where it says in verse 17. So in verse 16 it says, "But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name." And the person who's not properly evaluating himself, he's not really honest or humble about himself, can look at whatever's happening to him and be like, "Yeah, I'm just suffering for the sake of Christ." And then in verse 17 it says, "For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome of those who do not obey the gospel of God?" And it's just, to me, that's one of those really sobering verses. Like, man, if we claim, and I say that we should take this personally or as a church, or if we claim to be in the household of faith, let us always remember that that is exactly where judgment is going to begin. It's going to start there. I think some of Jesus' parables bear that out as well. Like in the parable of the servants and the citizens, you know, the landlord or the master gave the servants a talent to work with. The citizens were the people who said, "We don't want this man to rule over us." They rejected his authority. Well, when the master comes back, who does he go to first? He goes to the servants, and he deals with them, their judgment. And afterwards, he says, "Those citizens who said they don't want me to rule over them, bring them here and slay them." And I think that's what's going to happen when the Lord comes back. Before he deals with the pagans and the heathens, he's going to deal with the false church. And before he deals with the false church, he's going to start in the true church, in the household of faith. And there he's going to deal judgment first. And it should be a really sober reminder to us. And that's how I think those verses go together in a both encouraging and a sobering way. One other thought I had, kind of a little different subject, I guess, is verse 18. Actually, I'd be interested in hearing more just on what the actual meaning of the verse is, where it says, "And if it is with difficulty that the righteous are saved," or I think the King James translation said, "If the righteous scarcely be saved." I think we kind of get the meaning there. If it is with difficulty that the righteous be saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? It's one of these places where, like many other places, where it's quoting from the Old Testament, it's quoting from Proverbs 11:31. But if you go back to Proverbs 11:31 in the Masoretic text, it doesn't read exactly like that. It's close. Let's see if I can... Well, in the Masoretic text, it reads something like... This would be ESV, but most of them are close. "If the righteous is repaid on the earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner?" It's not really the idea of if the righteous scarcely be saved, or if the righteous with difficulty are saved. It's more like if the righteous are going to be recompensed on earth, if they're going to face their reward on earth, how much more the godless and sinners. But if you go to the Septuagint, it's almost a verbatim quote. In the Septuagint, the last verse of Proverbs 11 says, "If the righteous man is scarcely saved, then where shall an ungodly man and a sinner appear?"
Appreciate the comments, and thank you, Brother Duane, for expounding on that scarcely. As Walter Reddy starts, "Count it not strange that you be persecuted," and how's that strange? Notice these things, strange. But it wasn't strange to Peter. It wasn't strange. You know, Paul says, all who live godly will be persecuted. And of course, the theme, one of the themes, the theme is suffering in 1 Peter. And we have it kind of easy today. I mean, I say easy just because, you know, we're a Christian. We don't get, it was illegal religion back then. And you could get thrown in jail or your family could. But strange to have those fiery ordeals. But think of, in Deuteronomy, they had phylacteries, and well, they just had two phylacteries. The phylacteries they put on the arms or the forehead. Does anyone know what the two verses were? The phylacteries was two verses. Really simple. What we have a tendency to forget, and so God put phylacteries on the Israelites to know these two verses or phrases. Does anyone know what they were, Norman? You know what they're? Go ahead. Hear, O Israel, God is one. Yeah, that's one. Any other one? You got it. Thou shalt love the Lord, thy God, with thy whole heart, and like that, and phylactery. So if we had a phylactery today, for me, and if I think most of us, I think it would be Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers, or the Beatitude. But Jesus did say to love your enemies, and Brother Dwayne pointed out, let not anyone suffer as a murderer or a thief. But if someone was a murderer, either then or today, they'd be contradicting the Sermon on the Mount. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. Vengeance is mine. It's said in Romans, Hebrews, 1 Thessalonians. It's repeated in Deuteronomy. Vengeance is mine. I will repay. And thank you for those comments on 1 Peter. Let's remember that we are called to suffer, not to be put in a pedestal. The Lord be magnified.
I just thought I should maybe add, I'm sure there's deep meaning in that verse that says, if the righteous scarcely be saved, or some translations would say, if it is with difficulty that the righteous are saved. One thing that I would like to make clear, according to my understanding or of the rest of the scripture, I don't think that means that salvation is barely available, or that the salvation that we have in Jesus is scarcely good enough, or I think keep it in the context of 1 Peter. And of course I think Peter is just quoting a verse out of the Old Testament, because as he writes this, or as the Spirit leads him to write it, he remembers this proverb. I think it's saying something like, there are few that will be saved, because it's a difficult path, it's a narrow way, few find it, of those who find it, many fall away. It's a salvation that, it's a way that is against your flesh. It's against your old nature. It's against all those things. And so in that way, it's a salvation in which, especially if you look at the big picture of humanity, it's with difficulty or with scarcity that salvation is had for humanity. But anyway, unless someone would get the idea that the path of salvation, or the way of salvation, or the gift of salvation is just kind of like barely sufficient, I don't think that's what it means.
Yeah, I haven't heard all the comments, but one of the things that struck me as I read this was in verse 15. We have make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer, a thief, or an evildoer, which are all very plain. But then the last part, the meddler part, mine says, or a troublesome meddler, and different versions read differently. But that part struck me okay, what's in this for me as far as what would pertain to being a meddler in other men's affairs, or you know, room for interpretation there, I guess, and thought as we go about life. So that was all I had to share. If you have opinions on it, just feel free.
Leroy, I was looking at that last thing there too in that list, the meddler, and I just wonder, what is that? What is a meddler? There are ways that I think the scriptures are instructing us to be involved in each other's lives, like to be peacemakers, for instance, from Jesus, or to be trying to do good. Then again, there's that proverb that talks about he that meddles in other men's affairs is like a man that takes a dog by the ears. So there's a way of getting involved in things that is not profitable or good. I wondered if you had thoughts about that, Leroy. What is a meddler? And what were some of your takeaways? Because I'd like to know, too. I mean, there's definitely a way where people get involved in other people's affairs, and it feels like meddling. But what is that? What is that thing? What's the difference between peacemaking and meddling? Maybe if you're not trying to bring peace, but you're just trying to heap up fuel for the fire. I don't know. What, do you have any thoughts on that, Leroy?
Yeah, not really, but what struck me is like I could give it more thought, and any interaction I have with people, like, this could be something that maybe should be in my forefront, like, just is this just meddling on my part or not? And as far as like what would be the deciding factor, whether it's meddling or whether it's not meddling, I haven't locked that down.
Maybe to me it sounds like self-appointed interference could be. I don't know if our recent lesson on Job could be an example. They came to do something good. Instead, they were saying a bunch of things that they probably shouldn't have. Some things, maybe it was good, but if I think self-appointed, you know, like they're trying to put themselves in a situation that they have no wisdom in, and so it's just a burden.
Yeah, I don't have very much to share, but I had a few thoughts about the first verses that we read. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. And just had to think, like, why did he write that? And I think the reason is because our tendency, and you know, probably as well as their tendency, was to think that something strange is happening, like not to think of that as just the normal thing or the thing that we would expect or should expect as Christians. He was encouraging them not to think it strange, and I thought it just interesting to think how, like Brother Rob mentioned, Job, how, you know, everybody there thought it strange that Job was suffering these things, and they assumed that he must have been suffering as further down there it says, as either as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer of some sort was why he was suffering. And so I think, like, there was just that kind of tendency, I guess, in people to think it strange that Peter is addressing here. And then verse 13 says, but rejoice in as much as ye are partakers of Christ's suffering, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy. And I just think that that's pointing out that with along with the fiery trial, or after it comes exceeding joy, like, and I think like probably the harder the trial that people go through, and I think this can happen even to some extent here on earth, but I think he's ultimately saying here that he's talking about the reward after this life, I think, but I think this happens to some degree even here, is the more difficult the trial we go through, the greater the joy is afterward.
I don't remember where it's at, but it's in one of the epistles, I think. It was Paul talking about was it the single younger widows going from house to house, being gossips and busybodies. They were, I guess he was kind of trying to point out that it'd be good if they kept themselves occupied or got remarried for that reason.
Yeah, I was thinking some more about your question, Leroy, about Medler, and then also kind of in line with what Rob just shared. The King James translation there in our context in 1 Peter uses the word busybody. And I was just looking, that word is only used a few times. It's, if you look at the original Greek word, it's pretty long. I don't know how to break that word apart. But like Rob pointed out, and okay, so if you just think of the word busybody, busy sounds like someone, you know, that's busy, or that doesn't sound like idle, but in the other contexts where this is used, it's all kind of connected with somebody that's idle, like the one that Rob pointed out in 1 Timothy, where it's talking about those women that are not old enough to be in the number, and then it says, and withal they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers, and also busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. And then in 2 Thessalonians, where he's talking about the people who are walking disorderly, this is chapter 3, verse 11, for it says, for we hear that there are some which walk among you disorderly, working not at all, but are busybodies. So there again, it's kind of connected with somebody that's idle and a busybody at the same time.
Busy in all the wrong kind of ways.
And it made me think of, like, to Max's question, like, how are we to be involved in people's lives, speak into people's lives, be that peacemaker, be that brother's keeper, all those kind of things, but not be a meddler. And I think it just has a lot to do with, like, I think it has more to do with just our motives, but it would have to do with our motives, and then whether it's constructive. I had to kind of think of, like, let's suppose that things like this have happened, you know, at least to small degrees on job sites. You know, I can't just offhand think of it happening in a negative way very much, but like I've brought people, like maybe a new person worker on the job site, and he'll maybe just see the need for some things that we just kind of get used to and neglect. Like, he'll find crooked stakes and he'll just take the time to straighten them out, or a messy toolbox and just organize it. And he kind of knows what would be good, and he just does some of these things. And in some ways, he's just kind of meddling with our stuff. You know, and yet it's constructive, it's good. But imagine someone just kind of coming on the job site and, you know, digging through everything just to examine it and criticize it and put it back and complain. And like, that's anything but constructive. It's anything but helpful. Why is he even on the job site? Seems like kind of the difference, I think, between meddling and... So anyway, that was one of the thoughts I had.
I agree with you, Rob, on busybody, and you were talking about 1 Timothy 5, young widows, and it can be gossipers. But I think the main thrust, correct me if I'm wrong, is talking about they have left their first pledge. They did have an order of widows back then, young widows that they were basically supported financially in the first century by the church. So if she would break her pledge, it said they would wax wanting against Christ. So I think, I could be wrong, the primary reason of these young widows waxing against Christ is lust. And it says, let them marry. Now, it's not just for a young widow. I mean, that was they're breaking their pledge financially. But even young girls, I would say, I had Yolanda Nwanel, and I said, main three things, Norman, Dwayne, Walt, you have more daughters than me, but young women, they want three things out of a man. They want protection, they want someone to provide, and they want him to be a spiritual leader of the home. Those three things: protect them, provide, and be a spiritual leader. And may yet young women and the young men, may they all have that goal in mind. The Lord be magnified.
Think not trial strange for
Oh.
This is my commandment, that you love one another, that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another, that your joy may be full. That your joy somebody did.
Keep the thought of
Come bless us.